It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Webster Tarpley and Barry Zwicker. Webster Tarpley and Barry Zwicker are both leaders in the 9/11 truth movement. Webster Griffin Tarpley is a writer and historian whose books include George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Worst Financial Crash in History, and his latest book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. Barry Zwicker was a media critic on Canada's Vision TV for 15 years. He was director of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11, held in Toronto in May of 2004, and he is also an independent documentary producer, whose latest work is The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special You Never Saw, and it had a showing last night here in Seattle to a packed hall. And they're both here this morning to talk about 9/11. Barry and Webster, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Let me start with you, Barry, and ask why the continued focus on 9/11? Why this?
Well, 9/11 is very, very far from being history. It's driving history, but the events themselves are not a closed book by any means. And the 9/11 Commission did nothing to close that book. As you probably know, there's a marvelous book called The 9/11 Commission Report, Errors and Omissions, by David Griffin, and it calls the commission report a 571-page lie, which I concur with entirely. There are essentially four ways, it seems to me, that people approach the events of 9/11. If you go out in the street and ask them, and at meetings, and we did this last night at a meeting about 9/11, divided into four boxes, sort of a four-box questionnaire. Now, one box, if you were thinking of filling in what comes closest to your take on 9/11, would be the official story that 19 crazed Muslims led by Osama bin Laden, working from a laptop in a cave in Afghanistan, was behind the whole thing. That's the official story, indeed. The second box, you might call the incompetence theory, and that is that U.S. intelligence agencies, U.S. government in general, had some information about this planned monstrosity and failed. There were multiple failures of the intelligence community and the military to stop or even ameliorate the events of 9/11. And by the way, the first three of the four boxes have something in common. They all assume that there were 19 crazed Muslim hijackers. But the third box is a little darker, which is the Let It Happen on Purpose, or Lee Hop box. And that is that the U.S. intelligence community had a huge amount of information in advance about the alleged, quote, attacks, unquote, and deliberately failed to stop the attacks because the attacks would assist the agenda of the neocon cabal in his plans for resource theft and world domination. That's bad enough. But the fourth and final box is darker still. And it does not assume that there were 19 crazed Muslims. It is the inside job theory, the one to which I subscribe, and that means that at the White House, at the level of the White House, this was planned and executed in the USA, and it was a Reichstag fire 2001. So those are the four boxes. And more and more people, I think it's safe to say, it's a generalization, but I see a lot of evidence of this, more and more people are migrating through these boxes from one to four. And there are very few people now who actually believe the official story. I mean, very few people, period. Last night, when we took a vote on this at a place that was packed, I believe there were 250 people or so, I'm just being shown something with 249 people there. And I missed that other person, or I added person. Anyway, there were only two people, literally, who put up their hands, and no fun would be made of them, by the way. I said, we have to be honest about this, or there's no point in doing it, and no one will be laughed at for whatever their take is on 9/11. There were two people out of 249 people who said they believed in the official story. And this also is backed up by various polls that have been taken. So it's important, and there's a huge constituency of disbelievers, and that's where we stand today.
All right, Webster, you also had a good crowd at your book signing last night of your new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. What is your take on this?
Well, I would first of all agree with Barry that MyHop is essential. MyHop is the gold standard. It's the only way you can understand what happened, and it's also the only way that you can take measures to try to prevent a repetition. In other words, you're talking about state-sponsored false flag synthetic terrorism organized not by some group of characters from the Middle East, but coming from the bowels of the U.S. military security bureaucracy in the way that the Bay of Pigs did, or the Kennedy assassination, or the Gulf of Tonkin, or any of the other famous provocations that they've carried out. The closest reference is the Iran-Contra networks, right? The gun-running, drug-running, George Bush, Oliver North, Felix Rodriguez. That's the kind of people who would be behind 9/11 in the sense of MyHop, making it happen on purpose. I would like to appeal in particular, since we're going to be at the University of Washington Hub Auditorium, the Seattle Hub Campus, I guess it is, at 6 o'clock tonight. Barry and myself with slides and a lecture and a very good discussion, I'm sure. To appeal to people, if you're in the peace movement or if you're in the anti-globalization movement or anti-capital punishment or whatever it is, why should you care about this? Right? The 9/11 movement is numerically smaller than any of those, but I think really the most essential in the following sense. If you're concerned about the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, you want to prevent an attack on Iran, which I think is very much on the agenda. If you're concerned about Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, if you're concerned about totalitarian police state measures, wiretapping, things like this, I would submit to you that your only effective issue in stopping all that is September 11th. In the following way, Karl Rove has said it again this year, which he said in the past, but in January he said the entire basis of the Bush faction and the Republican campaign for 2006 is going to be 9/11. The Democrats accused of being pre-9/11 and the Republicans boasting that they're post-9/11. Now, the Democrats respond to that by running up and saying, oh, no, we're the true church of 9/11. We're the ones who really believe in al-Qaeda bin Laden, and we never got distracted by other gods in other temples like Saddam Hussein or the Iranians even. We're just focused completely on 9/11. I would say that the basis of this is that about 35 to 40% of the U.S. population are people of very limited mental equipment who have been successfully terrorized, scared out of their wits, by the terror demagogy of Bush, Rove, Cheney, and so forth. They literally believe this fantastic story that's being offered. If you go to them, you'll find that they're impervious to those issues. If you say Iraq, Guantanamo, they'll say that all is absolutely necessary as part of the war on terror. It's to defend us against bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Your only hope to break through that kind of a mindset is 9/11 truth. You've got to attack the myth itself. You've got to show this has very little, if anything, to do with the Middle East. It's largely a matter of power. It's U.S. World domination, the dollar, geopolitics, seizing Afghanistan, seizing other parts of the world, attacking the leading Arab state. And it's all generated here at home, so to speak. So the entire myth has to be taken down. What we really need right now is a 9/11 deep throat. Or we need a 9/11 Alexander Butterfield, the guy who revealed the existence of the taping system in the Nixon White House. We need revelations. We need to make this issue blow up. We've had some good progress since about March 20th. There's a big article in New York Magazine, the lifestyle magazine of the communications elite, and I'm fortunate enough to be quoted at some length in that. And then we had Charlie Sheen coming on Alex Jones, a conservative radio commentator, but anti-police state, anti-New World Order, and giving Charlie Sheen a big soapbox to basically attack the official version, and that got on CNN three nights in a row. I was on that for about 30 seconds at one point, and there's a lot of momentum around this now, and I think we're trying to conserve it. We're hearing from Venezuela, from Jimmy Walter, the millionaire political philanthropist, and William Rodriguez, the hero of the North Tower, the guy who saved people using his pass key and then had to be dug up out of a fire engine at the end of it, that President Chavez of Venezuela may be ready to call the 9/11 Truth Summit. In other words, what I would hope would be the Independent International Commission on 9/11 to get eminent personalities from around the world to hear a mass of evidence presented by people like Barry, myself, and many others who have done research and come up with a finding in the same way that the Russell Tribunal in Vietnam in 66-67 was the key to breaking the back of the Johnson administration's lies about Vietnam. I think we may be on the verge of something like that. If 9/11 comes down, so does the Bush presidency, the Republican Party, and a lot of other things that you don't like in terms of, well, even inequitable distribution of income and rollback of social services. All of that is motivated with 9/11. Punitive measures against immigrants are motivated by Republican demagogues with the notion that Al-Qaeda may be hiding among them. So it's the all-purpose reactionary ideology. You break that and you've opened up a whole new world of politics. So I urge people to become a part of this. I've had left liberals and radical liberals who would say, I'll do anything to stop a dictatorship. I'll do anything to stop the war in Iraq. And I said, well, in that case, you've got to start attacking the official version and tearing down this crazy myth. And some of them have been very reluctant to do so, right? The Noam Chomskys of this world have essentially struck out. The Amy Goodmans, the Michael Moores, the Greg Palast, and so forth. A lot of left liberal commentators who are quite sometimes decent on other issues, but won't touch this one for some reason. So we say, if you don't touch this one, you're not serious about pursuing the goals that you profess. Because if you want to stop the Iraq war, believe me, take it from Karl Rove, this is the way to do it. So I hope people will come. And again, we're at the University of Washington Hub Auditorium at 6 p.m. Barry is the first film journalist to put an attack on the 9/11 myth onto television in one of the larger Western countries. So he's a pioneer in that regard. And people will have plenty of chances, if you don't agree with this, to ask questions and to make criticisms. But I think it is clear, and we could do this at some length, that the official version is a tissue of lies. The Kane-Hamilton Commission is much worse than the Warren Commission in sense of never proving anything, never trying to prove anything, just asserting and taking it from there, begging the question.
Well, maybe you could touch on some of the inconsistencies in the official version, what you see as the most glaring ones.
Oh, there are a number that are glaring. I was a little late myself, I quite admit, to believing that the twin towers of the World Trade Center could have been brought down by other than these airplanes so spectacularly crashing into them and then them catching fire, and then allegedly the structures were weakened and fell down in a pancake effect. And I believed that when I saw it with my own eyes, as shows us that you can't trust your own eyes, shows us that reality in this world isn't necessarily what you see and what you think. And but this is now one of the most egregious cases of illusion, because clearly the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition. Never in history has a small fire in a steel-framed high-rise caused it to fall down. And it will never happen again either, unless there's another horrible similar attack. So that I think that quite a few people, especially in the New York City area, understand that this was a gigantic controlled demolition. It was, as Webster says, a dumb show. It was it was an illusionist's trick, and it was all pre-planned. And then there's the case, which is even more obvious, if you will, of World Trade Center Building Number 7. Which was a block from the Twin Towers, is less known in the general public as a case in point. And World Trade Center Building Number 7, at 5:20 on the afternoon of September 11, 2001, suddenly collapsed into its own footprint. And this building had not been hit by any airplanes. It had been barely scratched by the events of earlier in the day. And yet it suddenly collapsed. And the building's owner, a gentleman named Larry Silverstein, is on the record, on videotape. He was on a program on PBS called Rebuilding America. That you can buy that video. And he said, well, he talked to the fire chief, and there'd been a terrible loss of life, he said, that day. And so maybe the best thing was to pull the building. This is quote-unquote. Pull is a term in the demolition industry for demolish. So he said, we decided to do that, and we watched the building come down. Now, I think the least informed person knows that in order to have the controlled demolition of a large structure, it requires a great deal of planning, covering many days, probably weeks, and so that you get the explosive charges placed where they're supposed to be, the right kind of charges, and so forth. So obviously that was planned well in advance. And so to try to explain the collapse of Building 7 within the framework of the official story requires you then to believe that it was done by Osama bin Laden. So you'd wonder, well, what would Osama have to gain by sneaking Al-Qaeda members at night somehow past security into that building and planting all those explosive charges? And what would Osama have to gain? And furthermore, if it was, let's stick doggedly to this official version of what must have happened to Building 7. If Osama did it, then why wouldn't the U.S. government, and I have to add, the puppy dog mainstream media, that is just the official bullhorn of the establishment, why wouldn't they make a very big deal out of this? They say, my God, not only did Osama bring down the Twin Towers, but he just knocked down this other building later in the day just to rub it in our faces. But they instead overlook the 9/11 Commission report, literally does not mention that this building came down that day. Literally is not in the report. And, of course, the Bush administration has never mentioned anything about it, and the media have made it a non-building. So in other words, the collapse of Building 7 late that day is in and of itself what Malcolm Gladwell calls one thin slice. It's a piece of evidence that shows that the whole story is a tissue of lies, as Webster says. And furthermore, it illuminates that the cover-up that a cover-up occurred, because it's not mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. And so it also invalidates that report. And I find that when you talk with ordinary people on the street about it, it really makes them think, and as well it should.
I think one of the other things that really jumps out at people is the inconsistency with after the first plane hit the Twin Towers, that there was no fighter protection for like an hour and some minutes between when that happened and when the plane hit the Pentagon.
Yes, I think if you want to sum it up, you can say that for at least 1 hour and 45 minutes, and maybe for another 5 or so minutes after that, so almost 2 hours, absolutely zero air defense in the Northeast Corridor of the United States. Now, you have to ask yourself, how could any foreign agency accomplish that? You have to be the U.S. Air Force. You have to be the U.S. command structure itself in order to suppress air defense for something almost approaching 2 hours. It's simply inexplicable. Now, my method has been to go in and delve into the military drills and terror drills that were being held on 9/11, and it turns out that there were at least 15. We know of 15 so far on that day. It's probably the day that is densest with military drills and terror drills of any day in recent history. So you had a whole series, 4 or 5 drills that were taking aircraft out of that area, deliberately sending them to such places as Alaska, northern Canada, Iceland, also to the northern no-fly zone in Iraq. Some of them had been sent there. At the same time, these drills were introducing fake radar blips onto radar screens. They were involving military aircraft and commercial aircraft that were essentially fake. They were flying, but they were not scheduled flights, and they were signaling themselves as hijacked, so that there were probably, at one point, about 21 aircraft suspected of being hijacked in the morning. So you have all of that to suppress, disrupt, thin out the air defense. On top of this, however, you've got something called Global Guardian going, which means that before any hijackings had occurred, say at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, the United States was on a full, all-out Cuban Missile Crisis thermonuclear military red alert, with H-bombs loaded into B-52s and B-1s flying around, land-based missiles ready, submarines in position, ready to fire submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And you have to ask yourself, what is the connection? I have on the cover of my book, as you see, no falling buildings, but a thermonuclear mushroom cloud. You have to remember that later in the day, there's going to be the Bush-Putin telephone call. telling Putin, guess what? We're taking Afghanistan. You fought there for 10 years, but we're taking it. And we're also going to go into former Soviet Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, areas that are important for geopolitics, transport, oil, many other things. And the United States is going to seize positions in the Soviet sphere as a result of 9/11. Now, if President Putin had been a more traditional Red Army bullethead with a Mother Russia outlook, he might have responded to that ultimatum saying, this is going to mean thermonuclear war. So the U.S. was ready. In other words, the rogue network that was running the government, the invisible government behind the scenes, running Bush, in my opinion, running Cheney, possibly Richard Clark is the person on 9/11 who takes us closest to the activities of the invisible government, ironically, because he's the darling of the Democratic Party and has even pulled the wool over the eyes of some of the families of the bereaved victims. Cheney, of course, a part of it too. Bush piling on board as soon as it happens. They're going to launch an ultimatum against Putin, and they're ready on a nuclear level. The other thing I would point to is there's a drill at the National Reconnaissance Office that day, which involves flying planes into buildings. And I would say that is a very strong case that this was, in effect, the control center from which at least part of this was done. The NRO in Chantilly, Virginia, that they were using their consoles, their satellites, their equipment to direct the planes into the buildings using systems that we can probably speculate about which there's some disagreement about how this might have been done. But my starting point is the terror drills are bootlegged or conduited through officially sanctioned drills, maneuvers, exercises of the military security bureaucracy. So it's an attack, essentially, that comes at you from the bowels of the government.
And that nuclear alert level, did that occur prior to the
yes,
first
prior, break? Because it's part of the exercise called Global Guardian. It's why Brent Scowcroft, the Eminence Gris of the older Bush administration, remember him, was flying towards Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, towards the STRATCOM headquarters that day, to take part in the drill. Somebody else might say he's there to represent invisible government factions too, because he may be that as well. But certainly there's an all-out, a very large-scale nuclear drill going on before any of the terror events take place. And my thesis would be that's no coincidence. That's an integral part of how this thing had to be planned.
I wonder if I could ask Webster a question here that I've wondered about, and I don't think we've ever discussed this, Webster. I remember reading one report that Warren Buffett, one of the three richest persons in the world, was also at Offutt Air Force Base that day. Do you know whether, first of all, that is an accurate report? And if it is, what is the meaning of this?
Well, I think it's an accurate report. I think it's pretty clear that Warren Buffett, this multi-billionaire investor, right, one of the richest people in the world, not to slight Bill Gates, but certainly one of the richest people in the world, he was indeed at the STRATCOM, the old Strategic Air Command, now called STRATCOM in Offutt or Omaha, Nebraska. And why he was there, on the official explanation is there's some kind of a tour and a luncheon going on for bigwigs, but then you have to look, if you're going to have a military coup, which is what this is, and you've got Warren Buffett and you've got Brent Scowcroft, is that the nucleus of some kind of committee of public safety? Is that going to be the dictatorship, assuming that Bush and Cheney don't make it? Because they're expendable, too. They're not as important as many people think. And Bush and Cheney had fallen by the wayside, maybe a committee was going to emerge at Offutt, which would have been, in a sense, the dictatorship with no mask.
Now,
this is pure speculation now, but I think there's a certain plausibility. Those guys might have been preparing some alternate form of rule, which I hope we never get to see.
Well, I'm wondering, with Warren Buffett, I understand that, of course, he's a legendary investor. He was once asked, what is his philosophy of investment? And he said something like catatonic. In other words, he just puts money into what he believes will pay off. And he's been brilliant at this. And he leaves it. He's very patient. Now, I understand that he invested in reinsurance. These are the backers of insurance payouts, the reinsurers. It's a gigantic industry. Now, I would think that he would have a huge amount to lose because of all that destruction. And I wonder if they brought him into the middle of the inner sanctum to reassure him that he's not going to personally lose because of these events, that he would somehow be compensated, and would he kindly keep quiet about this? Because Warren Buffett, I think most people don't appreciate, is a bit of a humanist. He's a bit, I'm not sure if you call him left-leaning or liberal, but he certainly is not any raving right-wing lunatic. And he's a big fan of the British philosopher Bertrand Russell. I happen also to be. Webster may differ on this. That's fine. But the thing is that Warren Buffett has political leanings, shall we say, or beliefs that are very deep. He's very important in the world financial scene, and he would stand to be hurt badly by those events. So this has made it additionally curious to me about his role and who was saying what to whom, who was reassuring whom on what score.
I would only say that Warren Buffett is a close associate of George Shultz, who is, after all, the person who chose the current regime. He chose Bush, chose Cheney, chose the group calling themselves the Vulcans. This is Shultz, Condoleezza, Wolfowitz, all of these people. Buffett joined together with George Shultz to choose Arnold Schwarzenegger to be governor of California. So I would regard him as an establishment financier of no particular merit, let's say. But I think the broader fact is that there were things on September 11th that didn't happen that may have been much worse than what we actually saw, bad as that was. In other words, there were options that were built into this for escalation in various directions, which are chilling in the extreme, given the amount of nuclear hardware that's floating around and the question of Russia and the response of other governments to this coup. In other words, governments saying the madmen have taken power in Washington are capable of responding to that in very unpredictable ways. So that's why you have this constant hotline conversation between Armitage at the State Department and his counterparts in Moscow trying to say to the Russians, call off your drills, because they had drills going on too, nuclear, thermonuclear strategic drills. Let's avoid that. So there are dimensions of this that we haven't seen and parts of it that never occurred, bad as it was in reality.
Talking with Webster Tarpley and Barry Zwicker, who are both in town speaking tonight at a forum at the Hub on the University of Washington's Seattle campus from 6 to 10 p.m. And if you want to get tickets for that at this point, the best thing to do is show up at the door. Just a few seconds left. Final words from one or both of you.
Well, I think that we're probably, Webster and I, who have very enjoyable differences of opinion that advance our understandings, are united in the main. And we believe that this is absolutely central. The question of 9/11 is absolutely central, that it is the key to the future, really. We stand at a very bad situation, which we call A. We want to have a safer, saner world, which we call B, and the way from A to B is through 9/11 truth. Excuse me, I believe we're united on that, and that we also hope, and Webster has been particularly a leader in a drive to have a truly fair, comprehensive international commission or tribunal to find out the truth about 9/11 so the world can learn it. And I think those are twin agreements that energize us forward.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just been talking with Webster Tarpley and Barry Zwicker. Webster Tarpley, of course, is new book, 9/11, Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, and Barry Zwicker, who has just come out with his new documentary, The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw, and they are both speaking tonight at the Hub Auditorium on the University of Washington Seattle campus from 6 to 10 p.m., and you can get tickets at the door.